Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading.
So welcome to the podcast, Brianna Lovuskas. We've had some conversation about how to pronounce that correctly. So Brianna is a Wall Street Journal, Amazon Charts and Washington Post best-selling author. Brianna loves reading and writing in two of her favourite genres, psychological thrillers and historical fiction. Her latest novel, The Librarian of Burned Books, is inspired by the true story of the Council of Books in wartime, the World War II organisation founded by booksellers, publishers, librarians and authors to use books as weapons in the war of ideas. The Librarian of Burned Books is an unforgettable historical novel, a haunting love story and a testament to the beauty, power and goodness of the written word. Welcome, Brianna.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to chat to you. We've talked about this, but I'm actually listening to your book for the first time ever at Audible. I've always liked the feel of a book in my hand, but this time it's been an absolute eye-opener, I've got to say, listening as opposed to reading. And your book...
I didn't realise it was your first book that you've ever listened to.
Oh, yeah. It's my first ever.
Wow, what an honour.
And it's such a different experience. It's much more kind of intimate in a way because the narrator's there in your ear and you have to almost surrender yourself to the story a bit more. And actually, I really enjoy it.
I love that thought process. I listen to so many that... I think I go through about two books a week.
No just way, really?
I do. I walk my dog so much. She's high energy. Driving. So I end up going through a lot of audiobooks, but I just love it. And I love how much the narrators can bring to the story, how much life they can put into your words and stuff. Like your narrators are amazing. I loved listening to your book because I felt like I even knew the characters even better through their voices and like you said, intimately in your ears.
It's way more intimate, isn't it? It helps you to immerse much deeper in the story, I think. Because I'm not having to read it, that bit's taken away from me. So my imagination can unspool into something else. And I find I'm much more, when I'm listening to it, I'm actually in the streets of Berlin or Paris with your characters. It's wonderful. It's transformed my reading completely.
That's fantastic. So are you going to start, listening to audiobooks now?
Sure, for definite. Yeah, that's it. I'm talking now because, you know, all those empty hours as well, where I was walking the dogs or driving the kids to school or football or whatever. Why hadn't I been listening to books before? So yeah, thank you for being my first.
No, I think, I like to stay on top of those genres that I write in just for market research even.
For sure.
The amount of hours in a day are really hard to fit in a lot of reading. So like you said, like walking the dogs, going to errands, things like that. It's just easy to just throw on an audiobook.
Absolutely. So I've got to say, Brianna, your book was just sublime in so many ways. And I love, what I'm most impressed by, I think, is that you have a triple timeline. So you have your three characters or seen from the perspective of three different women, all in their own ways, illustrating the horror of war, but also the power of books. And I think it's so ambitious. For me, I was reading it listening to it, just thinking, wow, I don't know, this is such a hard thing to pull off. But I love that the way that the three women's lives sort of dovetail together. Can you start by just telling me about the listeners, the premise of the book and the kind of inspiration behind it?
Sure. Yeah. So the idea of the book came from, I was actually reading a nonfiction book called When Books Went to War. And there was a section in it about the Armed Services Editions, which were these lightweight paperbacks that the government sent to soldiers overseas to boost morale. What a concept, right? Like the idea that books could be this light in the midst of these really dark days. And everything, if you read a lot about war, you realize how common the story is that it's 97% boredom and then 3% like absolute terror.
Yeah. And so, punctuated by moments of violence and bloodshed, essentially. But
And your friends are dying beside you and you might die and all sorts of things. And the fact that books were the answer there, like, resounded so much for me, especially someone that's loved books my entire life and believe they're so powerful. And I had not heard that much about them. Like, they show up in a couple books that I'd read, but just mentions. And so I thought, oh, I just really want to tell this story. And there was also a censorship fight involved. And for me in the United States, that's also resonates in this moment of we're having a lot of censorship issues, political censorship issues. And so really, I thought that everything was coming together with that storyline. And like you said, so I like having multiple storylines. I just really like the process of weaving them together. That's just how I like to write. So I kind of try to start thinking about different ideas. So we have the pulse point is this censorship fight with over the armed services editions. And then I was like, you can't write about banned books without, you know, the 1933 book burnings. And so that's a storyline.
Yeah.
I was just researching. So I wanted one more and I was researching books in the war. Just kind of looking for like less known stories. And I found these two libraries in Paris and Brooklyn. And they existed to provide access to these books that the Nazis wanted to burn. And again, I was like, oh, these are like all of my themes like fitting perfectly together. and so it kind of felt like angels singing, you know what I mean?
You must have had a light bulb moment when you discovered that, because I hadn't realized that those are based on real libraries. Yeah. Wow.
Yes.
In Paris and Brooklyn.
Yeah. So they were very... quick mentions. I think it was just like on a Wikipedia article reading about books and war and stuff and or banned books. And they just a throwaway mention. And honestly, when I started diving deeper, there weren't a ton of mentions about it. They were really short lived. They were kind of like a blip. The Brooklyn Library did last until the 70s, but it was part of a Jewish center. So it doesn't get as much press. But yeah, so they exist. And the Paris one had all of these famous donors to it. Like,
really? Everyone, like,
so like Thomas Mann, the Mann brothers, but like any like big author in the 30s was like donating money into this library. And then there's just a lot of people with a lot of opinions and it kind of just collapsed on itself in that situation. But for the time that it existed, I thought it was, they're trying to warn everybody about fascism, this rolling tide of fascism that was coming across Europe. And I found that so romantic and perfect. And
yeah. It just fits so perfect. That you found these, you know, the two libraries, and then that ties in with, you know, Viv, your central protagonist, because it's just cementing those themes of censorship, isn't it? And why what people were fighting against. But I was really interested and stunned actually about the sort of the censorship in America during the Second World War. Can you tell me a bit about that, what your central protagonist is fighting against?
And this was all based on a real fight. Something that I find really interesting is how much, you know, propaganda during World War II on the home front really influences our thinking of how it was during that period. So, you know, we're the good guys, right? And so we don't ban books. But there were multiple censorship fights going on. The one that I picked for the Armed Services editions was a powerful senator named Robert Taft. He didn't like Roosevelt, and he wanted to get into the White House. And so this Armed Services editions was kind of attributed to Roosevelt and Eleanor, too. He wanted to essentially handcuff this program so that people weren't talking about, you know, it wasn't a campaign point for Roosevelt. And so he made this amendment that was really broad, like really wide reaching. And so almost all of the books that they wanted to include in the Armed Services editions kind of got swept up in this amendment. It was like, you know, Huckleberry Finn and...
I was amazed at those kind of books that were taken for granted and are now classics that were caught up in that net of censorship.
Yeah. And I think part of it was they wanted to make a point about how wide reaching this was, because the army included its own like user guide for their soldiers, because there was a picture of Roosevelt in it that called him the president. And so because that picture existed, they called it propaganda, because
really?
It was just,
wow.
That's how wide reaching it was. And so this fight was real and important, because it wasn't just like, oh, we're not going to send racy, you know, racy books or whatever. It was not that kind of fight. It was really he was trying to score political points, and it was obvious to everybody. And so they really rallied around it. But during the same time, one of the books that was included in the Armed Services editions, it's called Strange Fruit. It's about an interracial romance. It's not like super racy, and it wouldn't have been like any of that, but it was because it was interracial romance.
It was quite a controversial subject back then.
It was banned in Boston and Detroit, and it was banned from being sent through the mail.
Wow.
During World War II, where you're fighting against fascists who ban books. And so I just find it really interesting that, like, this has been banning books, like, the impulse has been around forever. It's probably going to be around forever. But
I find it so interesting because I love, in our minds, and I think for many readers, the perception of banned books comes, it's a sort of Nazi dictatorship that would ban books. We don't attribute that to so-called democracies, do we? And yet, when you get under the skin of it, it was rife. And I think that's what I love most, you know, I love the surprises in history. And reading your book gave me those surprises. It gave me an insight into that, that we wouldn't necessarily ascribe, you know, censorship to the allies, to the so-called good side.
I like including those moments for that reason, because I just think, you know, there were huge propaganda pushes that, like, the United States realized how potent of a message that was, that fascists burn books and democracies protect them. And they really drove it home. There's lots of posters out there about the importance of books. And I think that was a really strong message. And then to then have it happen, and you're having a senator, like a very powerful senator, that most people didn't want to make angry. Like, they didn't want to, you know, go up against him. And I think, you know, you can say, oh, you know, like books or whatever, but it kind of applies more broadly. So it's, you know, fascists are the ones who are anti-Semitic. But we also, you know, in the United States, Jewish people couldn't go to college, like in certain places, you know, fascists are like the bigots. And then you're like, okay, but like in the United States, we have segregated water fountains. And so I think it's kind of a really important, to me at least, to highlight the moments where is, you know, there's a lot of propaganda in our history, and that we just have to be really aware of that when we're trying to think through, like,
how it plays out now. I totally agree. I agree. I think, and there's so much propaganda, and so much is rooted in that thorny issue of morale. And I tend to think that actually sometimes when you scratch under the surface of that, you get a much more nuanced picture of it. And I think that's the beauty of writing fiction, is that you can explore those in ways that make it more relatable for people. Like, I love reading about Viv and her struggles and her grief and how she threw herself into fighting that censorship. You get to care about her character, and so because of that, you care about the issues at hand. For me, that's why I write historical fiction, so that you can present the past in a way that makes people care, I think.
I agree completely, and I think you do a phenomenal job at it, by the way. Your characters are so, like, you just root for them so much. But I think that people have always been people, you know, and I think that I think for people who don't read historical fiction, there might be some, like, almost like a barrier or a hesitation to be like, oh, I can't relate to this. But it's, you know, we see the same patterns, like we see this, the same behaviors and the same psychology all throughout history. And so I think the best historical fiction highlights the fact that people have always been people, and we've always had these same problems, even if they look a little bit different or in a different setting. And so I think you do that wonderfully, and I think it's really fun to write that.
Definitely. And it's interesting because I think there are so many parallels between our books. You know, they came out obviously in the same genre.
I know.
When I'm listening to it, and there are certain things that you say, and I think, God, yeah, that is exactly how I felt, like, particularly about knowledge is power and the role of librarians, but also the censorship fight, like in the wartime library, I go into a little bit about this fight against misogyny and patriarchy in my two female libraries, really trying to create a safe space for women, but fighting against this censorship that men had over what women read during the Second World War, you know, that women were emotional creatures and they needed to be pointed in the direction of sort of edifying fare, and that, God forbid, they read, you know, romantic fiction that might put ideas in their heads. So in a way, I almost felt like that women were fighting two wars. You know, there was the war against a Nazi totalitarian regime, but there was also this interior or more subtle war against misogyny, where women just fighting for the right to read anything that they need to enable them to escape.
I loved that. I mean, I was really frustrated by it. Like,
yeah.
No, I hate this. But I loved that aspect of your book. What was the book that they were, something Amber?
Oh,
what was
Forever it? Amber, which
Forever
was,
Amber.
Yeah, an amazing American author who had researched and written this incredible book, which, set during the Restoration, so during the bubonic plague and the Great Fire of London. And she's this irrepressible character, you know, who basically behaves like a man. She's sexually ruthless. She sort of romps her way through the ruins of Restoration London. And of course, it was absolutely, you know, they were burning it on the streets of Boston, because she was a woman behaving like a man. And that's why people hated it. But needless to say, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies.
But, you know, did you read it? Did you actually read
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I definitely read it, of course.
I gotta go read it.
Oh, you should read it. I mean, it's a massive book, but my God, it's so, the research that this woman must have put into it is phenomenal, because it's a huge book. It goes over several decades, but essentially, yeah, I mean, you get a real sense of the sort of the cart bumping over the cobbles and people bringing their bodies out through the bubonic plague and that the fire from the great, you know, the Great Fire of London and so forth. But it's just fascinating reading it, thinking and trying to imagine wartime women reading it and what they were getting out of it. Because in a way, this character, Amber Sinclair, almost sort of held a mirror up to the way wartime women were behaving, you know, with autonomy and more freedom and stepping out of the home and becoming more ruthless and earning more money and being, you know, more sexually litigious and so forth. So it was a fascinating little glimpse into what women enjoyed reading during wartime.
It was, it so lent itself so beautifully to your storyline. Did you find the book first, or did you go looking for a book that would represent, like, kind of your message?
So I kind of found it. And then I was like, why were people burning this on the streets of Boston? And you know, and it was banned at the port of Dover. And people, and I thought, what could be so inflammatory about this book? And then when I read it, I was like, oh yeah, I love this character. She is like my woman, you know? And then I imagine secretaries sort of reading it in stairwells and girls on their factory girls reading it on their breaks. Or, and also, you know, when you're sleeping down a dusty underground tunnel and you're living off powdered egg and life is boring. And like you said earlier, just privation and fear and boredom. What you want is to just step into a whole new world. You need that escape and scandal and colour and life. And so to step into those pages must have been such a sort of wonderful sanctuary and escape from the reality of life. So then I thought, yeah, well, once I read it, I thought, oh yeah, this is perfect to include.
Yeah.
What would the nose of a, you know, officious sort of male librarian more than that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we talk about the power of books, and I felt like that the way you did it was so like subtle, like how it influenced the women who were reading it, and like how books really can open up and unlock kind of these possibilities for women to do more and to be, you know, more than a punching bag, essentially.
Yeah, and to live vicariously through this character, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I just think that I thought it like beautifully illustrated like the power of books, like the power of actually changing, not just opening the world and entertaining and stuff, but also having that transformative power. And I think that that is something so unique about books. And I think you did, I just thought it was such a beautiful way to do it.
But I think I agree. And I think you did it beautifully too. There was one line that you said, there were many lines in your book actually that made me stop and really think, but you know, you said, you know, when you sell a man a book, you don't just sell him 12 ounces of paper and ink and glue. You sell him a whole new life, love, friendship, human, ships at sea by night. There's all heaven and earth in a book. And you wrote, it was as if someone had taken Viv's life and bottled it into a simple quote. And I absolutely love that. I actually had to pause the recording because I was like, oh yes, that is it. You have summed it up beautifully in that sentence alone. Because all life is within that book. You're not just buying a book. You are buying a whole new life, aren't you?
You are. I think, and I think for both of us, like for the people living in the tube, like you were saying, and then for men overseas living in these wartime situations, I think that idea was so powerful and important because they were so limited in what they were experiencing at the time. Mm-hmm. To be able to be have that, you know, take them somewhere else is so important.
Yeah, so Brenna, when I'm listening to a book and I'm thinking, oh, you've got these three different perspectives, and which I absolutely love and appreciate, but in my mind I'm also thinking, oh wow, how much research you must have put into this, and how you went about researching.
I am such a huge World War II history nerd. Like when I was a teenager, I used to read these military romances, and the author would always include a B storyline set in World War II. And ever since then, I was like obsessed. And so I read a ton of historical fiction. I read a ton of nonfiction set in World War II. So a lot of the basic research kind of just accumulated over like 15 years of this interest.
Oh, wow. So this is a long-standing kind of
relationship
almost.
I can't really explain why I love it so much, but I've listened to the great courses on a bunch of World War II topics and things like that. And so I have had a really kind of in-hand knowledge of the timelines and the big events, and, you know, 1930s Germany really interested me because I really liked knowing how it went from such like a democracy, a progressive democracy, really, to fascism so quickly. It's a good topic
you do explore that really well in your book, because I love the scenes where your character's going into the cabaret, and it's such an incredible, colorful, exotic, you know, welcoming, diverse world, to suddenly go from that to life just narrowing under that sort of Nazi dictatorship. You really explore that well. But what was life like in Berlin?
I think when you find something fascinating, you as a writer, it just comes more naturally to like make it, you know, interesting for the reader as well. And so I find it really interesting. And I think it's another thing that people don't really realize, that like in the 20s in Germany, you know, thriving queer culture, like really ahead of its time, the literacy rates were sky high. They were really trying to perfect a democracy. It was fledgling, but it was still democracy. Mm-hmm. And it was just this really progressive time. And again, that's going to be in the cities. You're not going to see it as much in the country, but I don't think a lot of people have that, not like that realization that it went so quickly, mm-hmm. so bad, so quickly. And there's always like a lot of like, how did this happen? And like all those types of questions. And you can see it happening. Like you can see the pushback against this progressivism lead swings towards fascism. And I think you're seeing that now in the United States.
And all around, certainly in England and in Europe. That kind of push back to the far right, the rise of fascism again is terrifying. But that's why history is so interesting, isn't it? Because when you look back, you know, you see it's anything but dusty and archaic. It's fresh and relevant.
It must have felt like
researching with the censorship and with this rise again of, you know, extreme views.
I think, you know, a lot of the questions come, you know, if I'm doing an interview with someone who maybe doesn't read historical fiction as much, and they're like, oh, like, how is this so relevant? And I'm like, there's so many time periods through history that are going to be relevant, but particularly this one, like you can see there's the drumbeats of fascism are so consistent. It's kind of hard to necessarily list definitively, but you know, like you see exactly what was happening. I wrote this in 2020. So like it wasn't even at the peak that it is now, and you just know what's coming. So that research was terrifying. But also fun. I also think researching time periods that we've gotten through to the other side is really gives me a little bit of hope. Like I said, you know, book burning has been around forever, and books always have always persevered so far. And our reverence for books has really pulled through all of humanity, even when people want to ban them. And so I kind of think about that, and I hold on to that when I'm feeling despair about our current situation. Beyond that, so I had kind of like a base knowledge. But then beyond that, I could kind of just that allowed me to like really dive deep into my like top, like my more narrow topics of the Council on Books in Wartime, which was a real organization that existed of, like you said in the intro, it was, you know, publishers and librarians and volunteers and all these people coming together to essentially use books to influence the war. And the libraries. Libraries were hard to find stuff on. Like I was saying, it was, I had to go to like academic journals.
Okay, that's interesting. And why is that? Do you think that the history of librarianship actually is a hard thing to research, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not a huge amount is known. I was very lucky doing mine because I came across what I would just term as sort of research gold. The Mass Observation Society did this huge survey into reading in wartime called Books in the Public. And they surveyed 10,000 people in the spring of 1942 to literally talk to them about what they were reading, how they read, where they read. And it was peppered with the thoughts of women who would just be lost to history, otherwise working women, talking about what they read underground and the vernacular and you know, that way of speaking and the phrases they used. It was just, I read it in the garden just thinking, oh wow, thank God for this, because I was able to just,
it gave me like chills, like that's such a
such a good find. I mean, thank you Mass Observation Society, because actually, you know, it was a barometer of how people were thinking and feeling. It was founded in 1936, I think. It was the same year that we had the abdication crisis. We had hunger marches on the street. It was a very restless sort of turbulent time, and so they founded this society to gauge the thoughts and feelings of ordinary people. And so because of that, I was able to read what were women reading, why did they read Gone with the Wind, what was so fascinating to women about it. So, you know, every now and again you'll come across, as an author, won't you, something like that, just gold, and it takes your story off in a completely different direction. I guess that's the unknown, isn't it, about researching. You don't know what you're going to find and how it'll influence your characters and your lives. That's why I love it. I love the surprises that turn up.
Me too. And I love kind of finding, like you're saying, like slightly off to the side research, like not just like your normal books on the topic or whatever. Yeah. But like, I love the New York Times' digital archive. They've like digitized all of their
I have to check that out. I haven't.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's just fun to look at too. I was a journalist for like 10, 15
years.
I can tell
you by your research, your meticulous research. No one else would go to that extremes that we did as journalists / authors.
Yeah. And so I'm such a nerd about journalism. But they have all of their papers digitized. So I went back and I looked at, you know, D-Day, the special edition, so I could see the front page on D-Day, and like what my characters were going to see. I looked up the Armed Services editions, and like they had little articles about those launching, like from 1943, 44. And you're like reading about the first, I love firsthand sources. And they, you know, I had, when Books Went to War was an immense tool for me, like that nonfiction book that gave me the idea in the first place, Molly Gopsel Manning, it's a fantastic book. But I found like the quotes that she used from the soldiers, like in the article, like it was just like a kind of a cool reference point.
I was just gonna say, sorry, funnily enough, when you were talking about D-Day, that's the point I'm at now. And I'd never stopped to consider what D-Day was like on the other side of the pond. You know, we hear it here thinking about it in England, but I suddenly thought, New York coming to a stop. You describe that so potently, and people.
Well, you know, I found a photo essay of D-Day in New York. So it was not. It was separate from the New York Times. I think it might have been Time Magazine. But there's these photos of these people just stopped and staring at the ticker on the New York Times building, and the like. It followed like throughout the whole day. So I was able to write this scene off of these photos and make it so authentic. Like I loved that chapter because it just felt like I was actually representing, like, because like what other day do you get where there's that many photos throughout like the entire
You do it so beautifully. You describe it, and I can almost, it just felt almost cinematic in a sense. I could see people, I could visualize it so clearly. It was so powerful for me, people stopping and, you know, the traffic trying to get through, and that you could feel the immense sense of expectation and the fatigue and exhaustion, you know, emotional exhaustion that people must have felt by that stage. I can tell you really enjoyed writing that.
I did. And I mean, thank you, but I do feel like so much of the credit goes to that photographer. It was just so, I don't know, like you just, it was almost easy to write because it was just, you have this, you're writing what you're seeing. I mean, obviously fictionalizing it and stuff, but I just, that's kind of those moments in research that are just so fun, like to find. I also found some articles about, like, you know, the book burnings, like how did people react to the book burnings in 1933, like in New York City. And there was a big protest. There was like thousands and thousands of marchers went out and protested.
Really?
May 11th. So they both, the burn the books on May 10th, May 11th, they went out and protested. So I think, again, people are people. So I just like those moments where it's like, you don't always hear about them, but like there was massive protests against it. There were some people who shrugged it off and thought, you know, this doesn't mean anything. It's just students, you know, having a good time or whatever. I like seeing those moments in history, getting to experience those firsthand research.
Are you, I can tell you know, you write beautifully, but are you, and you're obviously very comfortable and as the journalist and you like the research like I do as well, it's probably a much way more comfortable space for me to be in than the actual writing. I think if I could spend months, if not years, researching, then I'd be very happy because I can always use that as a procrastination point to actually stop myself coming to the page. But I learned just a funny story the other day. I was reading a review and somebody had put, oh, Thompson's really done her research. And I thought, and I sort of puffed up with pride and I thought, oh, yeah. And then the next line was, and doesn't she want us to know it? And I thought, oh, ouch. But actually, you know, they say you should never read your own reviews, but actually I really learned something from that. And I think that I learned from that point forth to have a lighter touch with research, just brush strokes sometimes, that not everybody, you know, for me, I realize wants to know that you've sat in the archives for 5 hours, that sometimes just less is more to sprinkle it on. That's something that I'm constantly wrestling with, I think. How do you find that how much to put in?
I think that is a hilarious review. first of all, I also disagree. I loved all your research in there. I thought it was, I do think it's a hard line to walk. Like you say, I think my agent is my first reader usually. And I remember the first draft of this and she's like, "Break, like this is a textbook."
Really?
Yeah. She's like, you need to not put every detail of history that you know and think is really cool. Cause like I said, like, and you are too, like we're both history nerds.
If I could live in the past, I would, you know, because it's obviously fascinating. Why wouldn't you want to know what people had for breakfast and you know, what color suits they were wearing? Everything to me is perennially fascinating about those times.
Me too. And so I think it's really addictive. Like it's an
addictive is the word.
Yeah. And you have to, and I'm with you. Like, I think that's one of the harder parts of research is you have all of this amazing knowledge that you've just absorbed from every other source or whatever. And like, how do you make that serve the plot?
Yes.
And so I just think I just have it all in my, I have to keep telling myself that. I think it was a really smart note from my agent. She was like, you know, I had them touring the place where the books on the Council on Books and Wartime was headquartered and like talking about all this history about them. And it's like, that's interesting, but like, is it moving the plot forward?
Is
at
it the
all?
Story?
Yeah. Is it the story that you're trying to tell?
It's
or are
you
trying
the story. To tell? And I think that's, And that's such an interesting thing that your agent picked up on. And I always try to remember that. Is it relevant, especially when you go back and you do the second draft, is it relevant? Is it moving the story on? Is it telling a story within a story?
Yep.
Or are you writing a nonfiction narrative? You know, that's what you have to try and, I guess, remind yourself of.
Yeah. And so I ended up just, you know, really slimming that back. And like I said, I'm obsessed with the 1933 timeline as well. There's so much stuff that happened in that January to June, really, chunk of time in 1933. And so I was like putting, you know, having the characters talk to each other about like every single detail that happened. And it was like, do they need to know about like they raided the union office? Like they probably don't need to know they raided the union offices in Germany. That has nothing to do with the book, but it's kind of cool. and so I think it is just, I think on my first drafts, now I'm kind of like, okay, I'm just going to put it all in and then strip it out. And that kind of solves the issue of like, I want to put it in and then like, okay, you put it in now really try to pull back a little bit. And really serve the plot. I think some of my, like, thriller writing helps with that, because like I have a pretty strong pacing now, and so I think I have like a have a little bit of a, you know, ace up my sleeve on that one. That I can
tell that. And on the subject of plot, are you one of these? Is this whole thing, isn't it, with writers? Do you plot in advance, or do you, or you know, some people like they plan exactly. I see some writers on Instagram and they have hundreds of post-it notes stuck all over walls and this sort of thing, and I think, God, that's very exacting. I like to think I'm somewhere in between. Like I definitely know where the story is going to go. I know roughly what the ending is, I know roughly what the middle is, and then I sort of think, well, okay, I can go off on little, say, you know, little deviate from the plot at times, but essentially I know where I'm going with it, but I don't try to plot it so tightly that I haven't got somewhere to go if, you know, you discover that book Forever Amber and you want to explore that. How do you do it? How meticulously do you plot?
I am very much a pantser.
Okay. The pantser.
I know where the ending is. Like, I know where I'm writing to 90% of the time. Every once in a while, I don't even know that. And I'm just like, we'll see. We'll head into the abyss. But I always call my first drafts like a really intense outline. It's really just me telling myself the story. And I think that weaving sensation of like the three points of view, I really need to keep open all possibilities, essentially, because, you know, I'm writing a chapter and then it's like, it could be like, boom, ends with like a twist or something. And I need to be able to then have that ripple out to the other, storylines. So I've seen those authors who have I was listening to an author give a chat one time, and again, anything that works for anybody, I'm not judging anything, but she had it down to the scene, the emotion and the scene within the chapter on note cards, and then she would pull one out and be like, this is how I'm feeling today, I'm going to write about this angsty emotional scene in this chapter. And I was like, that came so much anxiety.
Oh yeah, I'm feeling quite a tight chest just listening to that.
Right? I was like, I'm having a panic attack listening to this. Like, I couldn't even fathom writing that way. But yeah, so I'm more of like, I'm telling myself the story. And I think that, to me, I found that works for me. I also understand people who need to plot more. Like, I think whatever works for absolutely. You, run with it.
Absolutely. I agree 100% on that. And with your triple narrative, do you write each story out individually and then, or do you sort of just write it chronologically? You don't write each individual storyline like as if it was a book in its own right. How does that work? Having never done that kind of split narrative or, you know, timeline jumps, because it's quite complex, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's always been the natural way I tell a story. I think it's more popular in thriller. I mean, I think there's historical fiction, multiple points of view, but like having really that tightly woven interlaced is a thriller kind of thing. I don't, because I think they all rely on each other. I have heard authors who do write them out completely. And I think that would make it easier to make distinctive voices. So like, I do see the point of doing that.
It's a lot of work though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Essentially three books or two books that you're writing.
Yeah. But honestly, it almost acts as goalposts or something. Like, I don't know, like I'm able to better anchor the story as they go along. And so, you know, like an emotion or a reveal in one chapter is going to affect the very next chapter. Like, they're all going to have to make sense in order.
Yes.
I'm really bad at explaining.
No, I am understanding what you're saying. I just take my hat off to you, because it was a lot of three different strands of research over three different time periods to put it all together into a cohesive flowing story, which you've done beautifully, is no easy task. I know that. So I as a reader appreciate that.
Yeah, I think there are people who don't like it, and that's totally fair. Like, if that's not your jam, I get. Like, I think there is some people who just they don't like reading that way. But for me, that's how I've like all of my, I've always had multiple points of view. I just like that sensation at the end where everything kind of clicks into place. And so I do think I ask a little bit more, like for you have to pay attention and have to jump around and stuff. But then the payoff feels, I hope, feels worth it in the end
Yeah,
to get that.
definitely, because you get a bigger scope of history, because I'm not just in America, I'm in Paris, I'm in Berlin, and one of the other things that sort of leads me on to my next question, I love your book is very visceral, like when I'm listening to it, I can smell old glue, I can smell the Dharma, the cobbles, there's that real sort of textured feel to it, and I really appreciate that, and I often laugh because people think I'm weird because I love that sense of smell and touch and taste. And I once travelled, my husband still thinks I'm mad on this, 300 miles by train to Exeter, which is in the West Country, because a librarian told me, oh, you must come and smell one of our books. We have a book, the only book that survived when Exeter was bombed during the Blitz. All these books were burnt. And goodness knows, only knows how, but this one book survived, a man of letters, I think it was. And she said, we keep it in our vaults. Come along and have a smell of it. And I couldn't resist that. How could you?
No.
So I got the train down to smell this book. And it was amazing. It smelled of like sort of bonfires and a bit brackish and a bit moldy. And I just sort of put my head in the book and it really brought the Blitz in a way to life for me. How do you find your way into the past in that way? Beyond just sort of research, are there devices that you can use, because I felt in your book it was very, like I say, very visceral, like I got the sense of the smells and the sounds. How did you bring that to the page?
I think I'm just very cognizant of physicality when I write. I don't know, for some reason I that's what I like reading, so I always, that was what I admired about writers who I admired were able to really have the words so rooted in what we're experiencing. And I almost want to say journalism kind of emphasizes that as well. Like you want to put people in the moment, you want to put people in, what are you hearing? What are you smelling? What are you seeing? Not just what you're thinking. And so I think that has always been like in the back of my head, like to really delve into the world in like your five senses. And
that's such a good point, and you can tell that so much that that's your journalistic background coming to play.
It just like clicked for me. I'm like, you know what, that is what like I've been told in journalism classes. It's you use your five senses, and like
same we were taught the same in Fleet Street.
I think it really helps put readers into the moment, like you were saying. I'd also like to add that I don't think you're weird. I think we're soulmates. I would 100% do that as well. I love the smell of like the it's kind of indulgent, but the smell of books is just so like. I always try to put a couple sentences in, but you know.
Yeah. Oh, same. I love it. When I ordered Forever Amber, the book obviously that I featured in the Wartime Library, and it was an old copy. And I could, as soon as I opened the package, the smell just reached out and sort of grabbed me. And I was like, that smell of old books, it's hard to put words to it, isn't it? Mildewy and damp, but sort of earthy and rich at the same time. I think if you could bottle that as a perfume, we'd be onto a winner.
I know. I've smelled, they've done it for candles. Like they'll put candles, like old book candles. I mean, they're not always perfect. They're not the same. But
yeah.
Like that little bit of a hit when you need it.
But no, I really appreciated those touches in your books. And one of the things I've got to ask as well is, you know, you have written the Librarian of Burn books, I've written the Little Wartime Library, but there is a whole raft of other titles out there, like books about books. You know, it's virtually a sort of genre in its own right. And this seems to me to be not a recent thing, but certainly over the last couple of years this is picking up pace. Why and you see it in reviews as well, don't you? People say, oh, if it's a book about a book, I'm there, you know, they've ordered it before they even know what it's about. Thank goodness they do, it's great for us. But what do you think is, why do these books have such a hold on our heart? What are they making us feel that compels somebody to order it or and fall in love with that? What is it, do you think?
I think Because if you're reading books and you're buying books, and you're investing time, which is such a premium these days, right? Like, we're all so busy. And like, you have your phone. Like, so if you don't want to, if you're not a book person, you're not going to be buying books. But so you're already like, this is like the thing that you like. And then there's like a about the thing that like a book about the things that you already like. So it's like, I get really jazzed about, World War II history or whatever. So I'm like jazzed when there's a World War II history book. So I think book people are like, this is my thing that I like so much. And then I get to read about it, like, and doing the thing that I like. So I think it's almost like a double whammy of like,
I guess it's like permission to switch off, isn't it? It's permission to kind of already fall in love with the characters.
and I think that, writing the librarian and then reading books that are just celebrating the reverence of books is just, it like turns on all my happy thoughts. Like, that brain cells.
I mean, there's love on those pages. You can tell when you're writing about the libraries, and especially Viv, your central character, how she feels about books and what they gave to her to overcome grief and for escapism. And when she was arranging for the books to be sent to these American servicemen, what it must have given them is explained so beautifully. And I think that is echoed in all of us, isn't it?
It is. I think, we're reading book. Like, we already have that love. Like, we already have that. You're like, oh, you recognize someone who's similar to you. Like, you recognize another soul that is resonates in your soul, which is so like hippy dippy. I'm sorry.
I love it. I love the words that you used in connection to it, like it reverberating through her fingers, that feel, that tactile love and feel of books. It seems from every page, I think.
I think it's just, I've all like you were talking in your, I think it was your author's note that, your childhood library, and that resonated so much with me. I was like, oh my God, I've had that exact same experience. Like, your mom is talking with the checkout.
Really?
And yeah, like, it just feels like, I mean, I grew up in a small town, so like our library was tiny, and I used to spend my free time in libraries. I love books, and so reading about someone else writing about how much they love books is always just going to make me happy. So I think that's kind of part of it. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with you. And as you're saying this, I'm really smiling because I'm thinking in my head, I'm imagining me as a 7-year-old girl in my little local library in Molesey. I went with my mum every week and I absolutely loved it. I had quite a noisy household, brothers, sisters, dogs, but in the library, I love that sense of quiet, not boring quiet, but quiet that sort of vibrated through the stacks. And I used to love going, I'd take a book and I'd fall into it. And for me, that was really my happy place. And I get such a kick thinking of you. We're probably about the same age, maybe you're a bit younger than me, but on the other side of the Atlantic, doing exactly the same thing. And this was what I think made a writer of me. If I don't think if I hadn't have gone to the library every single week and read voraciously, I wouldn't be a writer now. I think it opened up my imagination in a way that unlocked it and allowed me to imagine my way into different worlds. And I think without that access to books and reading, I wouldn't be a writer, no doubt about it. But I get such a kick of thinking of you the same time on the other side of the pond doing quite exactly the same thing. And that just shows what libraries give us, doesn't it?
I think that, yeah, like that was so fun to read and to picture and to know. Like, it's just so universal. And there's a quick scene in The Librarian where Viv is kind of reading a book that she knows is part of the Armed Services Edition. So she's like, she knows that all around the world there are other people who are reading that very book in that very moment, and maybe not thinking the exact same thoughts, but having the same experience. And that was really important to me to include. It's only like a couple paragraphs, but she's like, this connects us. This is humanity connected with this spider web of all of us reading this one book together. I think it's a powerful concept, and I just really enjoyed being able to explore it. But I'm kind of having that same experience, like picturing us like in little libraries,
So true. And that's true of libraries because every country, to my knowledge, in the world has a library. It's a universal thing. It's our greatest invention, isn't it? So I
It
suppose
is.
that does explain that relevance and why we feel that attraction and that empathy towards other people that like books, and because libraries are universal.
Well, I really liked that you, like, the library is more than just books for you in that, yes, in your book especially. Like, I felt like it's, you know, a meeting place and a resource and, you know, a place for human connection, like we were just saying. Like, I thought that you did that so beautifully in terms of a library is more than just a place, you know, like it's a concept. And it was either in your author's note or the Bethnal Green one, but you were like, when a library closes, bad things happen in the area. And that, like, that plays out in the United States as well. Like, it is a place for the community that holds it together. And even if it kind of flies under the radar, it ends up being such a monumentally important aspect of the community.
Agreed. And because it's such a unique space, isn't it? And this really occurred to me as I was writing it and suddenly thinking about the role of libraries, that actually is the only place that you can go generally on a high street from cradle to grave that is free, safe, democratic. You're not expected to part with a penny to travel the world. And I suddenly got blown away by that concept. I thought, yeah, actually, this is true. And one librarian said to me, you know, if I went onto Dragon's Den or one of those programs and I had to sell the concept of a library, look, we're going to give all, we've got all these books and we're just going to lend them out for free. It's a very bad business model. But that's what makes it so such a civilized part of any functioning democracy, is that we do have access to knowledge, to power, to enlightenment. And that's very unique. I can't think of another service that provides that.
No.
So I was thinking, Brianna, about especially the themes that you talk about in the book. And it really occurred to me that, like, a library is like a microcosm of life, you know, like all life goes in there. And I think that by taking a sort of peek almost behind the scenes or behind the stacks, that we get a glimpse of humanity as a whole. And that was something I tried very much to put into the wartime library, that you never knew who was going to walk through the door or what was going to happen each day. Did you get that sense doing your research?
I did. Yeah. I think it draws, you know, all sorts of people and situations. I think you mentioned, I keep referencing your author's notes, sorry, but I think you mentioned, like, a librarian had, like, an overdose in her lobby.
Yeah. The same one, actually, where I went to smell the book, the librarian there was telling me, yeah, she said, like, she said that, you know, only the other day, she said, I came in and they've got quite a large homeless population near her library, and that she'd come in the other day and somebody had taken an overdose in the foyer. And I just thought, and it made me, you know, and everybody that I interviewed had, depending on what sort of area they were in, had similar-ish stories. And it made me realize actually how much of a frontline worker a librarian is, that they're used to dealing with the disenfranchised and the vulnerable and the lonely, and that often a librarian might be the only person that someone sees all day. So that made me think, well, actually, that role of librarians, they're almost like, I don't know what the equivalent is in America, but citizens, vice bureau workers, social workers, confidants.
Social workers. I was like, I don't know if you guys have this term either. I was.
Yeah. I guess it's like somebody who helps people, essentially a social worker. You go there for free advice. But that's the roles they're playing, particularly in our country today, where libraries are cut to the bone more often than not. You know, particularly in this cost of living crisis that we're going through, that librarians see and deal with the most extraordinary situations on a daily basis. It's very rarely about books nowadays.
And yeah, we're asking them to do so much. We're asking them to be so much, and they do it. They rise to the task. Yeah. They're amazing. I mean, they're book people. I always love the book people.
You always try the book person.
But then, you know, and then we're at the same time being like, we're going to pay you very little and we're going to cut your funding and you're not going to be able to do this and this and this. And you have to be like guardians against, you know, censorship and like, I don't know. I just feel like they're so important. They play such an important role in the community, and yet we don't really value it. And you see that time and again with, you know, teachers, and it's not nothing new, but I do feel like it's especially with them too.
Yeah. But you have in a way that I do, a different perspective, because we've analyzed and researched in great depth, like, the roles that librarians played in wartime, like how agile and creative they were and how they rose to the occasion. And how, you know, and that was 80 years ago, and how they were doing that way before that, and how they continue to do that. So we get a really good wide scope of what they've been doing. And I guess it frustrates me because I realize how underappreciated, but also how misunderstood the role of librarians actually are. in terms of the breadth of their work and what they do, you know, that in the way that a library is so much more than a repository of books, a librarian is so much more than somebody who just stamps books and recommends them.
I think you portrayed that well with Clara or Clara? Clara?
Clara, because she can Clara. Be Clara or Clara, I don't mind.
Clara. but I feel like she, you know, when she, like even like the little things, like where she was like guessing someone's favorite book or whatever, or talking with the children, the aspect of the children of like what getting them into reading and just being, you know, like a little bit mad, like having a little magic, like,
yeah,
not that she was a witch, so that should be burned at the stake, but I think that's like the physical portrayal, but like the overall arching, like she knows the community, she knows her community members, and she knows what people need, even if it's not necessarily just, you know, here's the most, you know, read book, here, go read it or whatever. I think that I really liked that aspect of her being able to be so empathetic to all of her patrons.
Yeah. And she was like a really just the embodiment of all those interviews that I did with librarians. She was just a little piece of all of them. Like there was this one librarian that I interviewed. She was amazing. She worked in Stoke Newington. And she said to me, you know, I know almost before people open their mouths what it is they want. I can tell from their body language, they approach the counter, I know what it is they need, because everybody coming into a library is in need of something: enrichment, education, help, whatever it is, we all need something, and that library fulfills that need in their lives. And she was, you know, she was the closest I come to magic. She was just like so calm and wise, and I just thought, wow, this woman, she, you know, she there was a certain sort of everyday magic about her, I think.
Yeah, just the ability to like read people and to be so empathetic, to be, you know, so open to trying to help someone, to end up with that kind of personality and that kind of eye for it is just a really special person, I think.
For sure. And a good sense of humor too, because when you deal with the general public day in, day
yeah.
out, one woman said to me, she goes, you know, if you want to see the world, don't join the army, become a librarian. And I gradually began to see what it was she meant by that, the extremes of the scenarios that they face every day.
I actually have a friend who's a librarian, and every once in a while she'll just, you know, relate a funny story from the day, and it's like a sitcom sometimes. You're like a workplace sitcom of like, you know, people.
Yeah, a farce. So tell me, Brenna, what's your tell me a little bit about your library, actually, your childhood library. What was it like, and what sort of books did you love to read as a child?
I have such like a like sense memory of this place, but it was really like half of a block, brick building, and it, the adult level was on the ground floor, like where you walked in, and then you would go down this like staircase into the kids level. And I loved it so much. And whenever we got to go, I read all sorts of things. I think I quickly morphed into romance. I love romance. When I was a teen, when I was a kid, I was reading, you know, Tuck Everlasting, Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass.
Oh, yeah. It was
one of those first books to me that really gave me my favorite feeling in the entire world. Like in the entire world is when you're so into a book that everything else just becomes like white noise, like blurs out. You're so into it.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think I read it when I was like 10 or 11. That was really the first book where I was like, I lost the world around me. Like I lost the physical world, and I was so immersed.
That's
in
such a good way of putting it. I lost the world around me. I love that.
To the point where like people would like call my name and I just like wouldn't respond, because like that was like a very common habit of mine.
I was just the same.
Right? Like you just get so, and it's just my favorite feeling.
Isn't that wonderful when the book gets into like that? I remember going once on a canal barge trip with my mum and dad, and I just was into a book. I can't even remember what it was, but they couldn't even get me out. My mum was like, come out up on deck. Look at this countryside that's going past. I just didn't care.
I know. Well, I was
reading. I have my world and I was in it.
Yes. I was reading The Golden Compass when we were doing a 3-week tour of Scotland. And so I'm like this tent, like my parents planned this beautiful like castle tour, like this landscape that we had never seen before and all sorts of stuff. And I'm sitting like in the, I'm sure they wanted to kill me, but I was like in the back seat with my like head buried in a book while we're like,
oh, I can imagine that. I can so imagine that, like majestic mountains lost sweeping past, lost to you,
like docks and castles. And I was like,
original bookworm.
Yeah, by the time I was like 12, I was like reading those like little romances they make for like preteens. And there's this American, I think she's American, her name's Lurleen McDaniel. And she has this very specific, I call it a her genre, where she writes these like romances, but they're always tragic. One of them is always dying of cancer or brain tumor.
Oh, no.
One of the famous ones was the main girl character fell in love with a kid who had cancer and he died. And then she fell in love with someone else in the next book. And then she developed cancer and died.
What appealed to you about that when you were young?
Like, as I'm talking about it, I'm like, what? I think it was just like the...
It's a drama?
The yeah. drama.
Yeah. You must have been getting that out of it. But isn't it funny what, like, so when you're reminding me, when I was younger, I think I must have been sort of prepubescent. I used to love the Sweet Valley High series because, you know, where I was from, we didn't have milk bars or dairy bars and people didn't go to proms, and it just gave me, my god, I used to devour those books. And I wanted to live in California, and I wanted to be, you know, Jessica and her sister. I really wanted to live in Sweet Valley High. It was everything. My world was not, you know?
Like I said, I grew up in this tiny town. Nothing really interesting ever happened to us. I mean, it was great looking back on it, but at the time I was like, I want to like read about drama and like all these things that aren't actually in my life.
Yeah. That's what a good book can give you, isn't it? It's like we were saying earlier, you don't just buy a book, you get a new world. And what's better than that? So if you were sent off to a desert island, and this is an impossible question, but and you could only take one book, what would it be?
I know. I was trying to think what I would answer because it's almost like trying to answer, like, what's your favorite book, right?
It's an impossible question. I appreciate how impossible that question is.
Like I said, I have this really soft spot for romances. They make me feel like they're like my happy place. They're like, yeah, if I'm having a good day or if I just want to like spend the day reading or whatever, I tend to read a romance. So there's this, so random, but I like an ice hockey romance book called Heated Rivalry that I just love. I've read it like 5 times now. So I think if I was on...
I'm gonna check that out.
Okay, well, yeah, it's just hockey romance. I don't know, it's so good though. But I think they're like my equivalent of like a warm blanket and warm tea and stuff.
That's your comfort blanket of a book. Oh, that's such a good answer. I'm definitely gonna check that. I think I need to read more romance. I don't think I'm quite romantic enough.
Are you not? What would you take?
Oh God, that's a really good. I love Rebecca, the book Rebecca. Oh. I don't know what it is about it. I love old houses. And she writes so beautifully. And it's a real taut, kind of crisp sort of book full of jeopardy, but history. It's got everything that like steeped in the past. I love that kind of sense of, again, walking into a world that I can never go. Like, we can never go back in time, but books can take us there. You know, like, if I could have a time machine to take me to 1940s, you know, the sort of blitz-battered streets of the East End, I would love to see that. But I don't. So I can only read books to take myself there.
Yeah. And I mean, they do a pretty good job.
Yeah, they do. Well, Brianna, you and I, we could probably just talk for hours and hours on the subject of history and writing. But thank you so much for being on, you know, my inaugural, my first ever podcast interviewee. I absolutely loved The Librarian of Burn Books. I must ask you, actually, what are you working on next?
That was going to be my final question for you. I'm waiting on edits for my second historical, which is about the books that Nazis plundered. So you know how so they do like a lot of focus has been on the art and like where the restoration, like returning it to like their owners and stuff, but they also plundered about like millions of books from private citizens but also from research libraries. And there's this big institute that was dedicated to preserving the Yiddish language, and so they plundered all those books. So it was going to be destroyed, it was going to be lost to history. And then after the war in 1946, there was this big effort from the United States government to return all those books. So there was like a depot in Frankfurt where all these books came. And that's kind of like one of the book line, the book storylines.
Oh, such a good idea. Oh.
And yeah. So I was reading, I have a nonfiction book that has given me ideas for like both of my, I just love it so much. It's like The Book Thieves, I think it's called. And it talks about like the plunder of those books. But in it, they talk about this one book that they found this personalized book, and they were able to trace it back to the person's granddaughter, essentially. And they take you through returning it to her. And you would think it's just like, you know, a book that can be reprinted. But it was, she started crying because the grandfather's writing was on the title page. And I don't know, it just was so emotional. I was like, this is such a good idea for a story. And so the plot.
You've got me just with that little story alone. That's really? Such an incredible story. Wow.
So the plot line is essentially this librarian goes and helps out with this effort to return all these books. And she finds a particular book within an inscription that she finds really intriguing. And then she goes and it's about these two sisters and what happened to them during the war and stuff like
that.
So.
Oh, that is actually putting chills up my spine. That is
so good.
Yeah. Because I never even stopped to think about that. What happened to all the book? Yeah. We know about the artwork, the priceless artwork and the statues and so forth and the painting. Yep. But what about the books? What happened to them after the war? So that is brilliant.
I was pretty jazzed to have found. You know, it's nonfiction
right here. It's one tiny little story.
Yep.
Can be often just what you need for everything to burst into life after that.
I mean, and that's what happened with the Armed Services editions too, is like I found it's just, you know, it was a chapter in this book and I was like, oh, that's such a good, I think historical fiction talent or skill for historical fiction writers is being able to find those slivers because, you know, World War II is such like a covered topic.
It's such a well-mined, you know, and to find to be able to tap in and source something that hasn't been explored is getting rarer and rarer now. So to find those little fragments, you know, tiny little things that gleam out that oh God, that hasn't been done before. You know, you have to have a magpie's eye, don't you?
Magpie's eye. That's actually so smart. That's a great way to put it. I think it's so true.
You have the magpie eye.
I try. Whether it's executed or not, we'll see. But
does that have a working title yet, or is it still just to be decided?
It's kind of to be decided. We are thinking the lost book of Bonn. Bonn is where the depot was. Bonn was where the sisters lived. And where the book was lost. So the lost book of Bonn, maybe one of the storylines is about the only protest against the mass deportations of Jews in Germany. It was on Rose Street, and about 2,000 Jewish men were rounded up as part of the final roundup, and their wives went out and protested.
God, and it was that's brave.
I know. And it was like this week long protest. It was like super cinematic and they faced down gun, like they were shot at. The RAF bombed them. Coincidentally, they didn't do it on purpose, obviously, but it was the Luftwaffe's anniversary. So they RAF bombed them.
They got caught up in that.
And they were successful in the end. And so like that's another like slice that I don't really haven't heard that much of.
This book is pretty epic, I can tell already.
I hope it's good. But it was on a street called Rose Street. And so my point is that we might try to work that into the title as well somehow. I don't know.
Rose Street.
But then Kate Quinn has Rose Cone. So it's just kind of.
Yeah, it could be a bit similar. But the lost book, that's very intriguing. Something around the lost book or the lost books of Rose Street or Bonn or if you pull that together.
Yeah.
Well, so have you actually started researching that or what stage are you at with it?
So that's it's done. I'm waiting for my editor to get back to me. We haven't started edits yet. Uh-huh. I turned it in February.
Oh, so you were in that nerve-wracking stage. Waiting for the feedback.
Yeah. My agent has a really good editorial eye, so she's I kind of can take her word where she's like, yeah, it was good. So I'm hoping the editor will think the same. But yeah, it is kind of nerve-wracking and it's like silence and you're like,
yeah.
Okay, what did you think about it?
I can relate to that. I can really relate to it. Oh, that sounds so amazing. I cannot wait to read that one. I've got to say, I just love the sound of it. It's so intriguing. And would you write more historical fiction, do you think? Or is will you go back to psychological thrillers? What's the future?
So I am kind of trying to do both. We'll see how long it lasts.
How long you can juggle that one for.
How long I can juggle that one for. So, you know, I'm human, so we'll see. But I really like writing in both genres. I think it gives me a fresh take every time. So it's, you know, I'm not burnt out of either genre. A genre I can come back to and be like, oh, this is fun again. And like, oh, this is fun again. So I would love to continue writing in both genres. I really, really like historical fiction now, but I also think it's kind of newer to me. Like I've been writing psychological thrillers for, you know, 8-9 years. So there's kind of a newness factor for the historical fiction, but a lot of the aspects of writing in both of those genres are kind of similar. They're both, I always just say like, they're both amplified human emotion, you know, war and like, fear, courage, like.
Yeah. I can see that.
You know, it's amplified human emotions, which is really what I really like. I think there are people who do.
We're asking the reader to feel things, aren't we? We want to have a whole range of emotions, be that a thriller or historical fiction.
And having like really high stakes. I really like high stakes. Mm-hmm. I think you like slice of life really well, but I don't think I do. So I really like doing those, like you're in really, you know, the blitz. Like
life-affirming or life death-defying situations, anything where there's jeopardy, I really enjoy.
Yes. So you find that in both of them, you know, the little things are different, but a lot of the big stuff is kind of similar. So,
good for you. I take my hat off to you writing in two different disciplines. I appreciate it's a good way to keep your writing fresh. It's a good discipline to get into, but it just must make you a very busy woman.
Wait, what are you working on?
Well, so I'm in a similar state to where you are, actually. I've just filed the second draft of the Wartime Book Club. It's the book club thing, isn't it? It's not a follow-on. I like to think of it as almost like a companion book, because it's set in another library, but this time it's set in St Helier Library, which is in Jersey in the Channel Islands. The Channel Islands are intriguing to me. I went to visit Jersey actually for the Jersey Literary Festival in 2018, and it's like how you were saying, all you need is a slither, just one tiny little thing to catch your eye. And I was in the Jersey war tunnels, and there was a plaque on the wall, and obviously Jersey, like all the Channel Islands, was the only part of British territory to be invaded and occupied by the Germans. So it's fascinating in a way, because it was almost like the Germans were using it as a blueprint for what it would be like when they invaded England, which obviously never came to pass. But of course, you know, so Channel Islanders didn't have to put up with the Blitz, but they did have to live alongside the enemy, and that created a whole quagmire of issues especially for women living there. But anyway, I was in this museum, it's called the Jersey War Tunnels. And there was a plaque on the wall, and it just talked about the postal workers in Jersey and how there was this awful thing. And it was, you got this in any occupied country, you know, occupation inject poison into the areas that they are. So there was this culture of people denouncing their neighbours, mainly because they were starving and terrified. But, you know, you get people writing to the German commandant saying, check out my neighbour so-and-so, she's got a hidden wireless in her basement or whatever. But in the post office, what they would do if a letter came in addressed to the German commandant, they would steam it open, and then they would get on their bikes and they would warn the person that had been denounced, and they say, I'm going to hold this letter back for 24 hours, you've got to get rid of that wireless or that hidden pig, you've got 24 hours to make yourself whiter than white, and essentially warn the person, and then they would date stamp the letter and then send it on, and creating this little window of time for people to go and just save themselves. And so when the Germans came and searched, they wouldn't find anything. And so in doing so, for me, this is heroic. It's resistance. You know?
Absolutely heroic. Yeah.
And yet there's this common narrative that there was no resistance in the Channel Islands. And I read this and I thought, that's amazing. That's incredible. And so that is, you know, I have one of my protagonists be as a postwoman. And this is what she does. She goes around warning people, but she gets more and more, I suppose as she gets angrier and tired, as she takes more and more risks, until eventually she starts keeping the letters with the view of after the liberation, she would round up and seek vengeance. So it's all about that. And her best friend works in the library. So together The librarian is smuggling books to Jewish people in hiding. The other friend is opening these letters. So these two are sort of subversive resistance fighters, and it's all about that. And then they form a book club. I need to narrow my pitch
down. So great! Oh my gosh! That sounds amazing.
Oh yeah, I've got to say I became a bit obsessed with Jersey and the Channel Islands. It's such
no, I find it fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
So do I. You know, I guess we all know, don't we, the Guernsey Literary Potato Peel Pie Society, which is a fantastic book, isn't it? I mean,
it was what started me reading historical fiction, actually.
Really? Oh, really? It's beautifully written, isn't it? I think she did such a great job with that. So yeah, so that's my next book, and I finished that actually, and now I'm tentatively thinking I'm in the process of putting together a synopsis for a nonfiction called Ooh. The Librarian of Kabul. So I've interviewed this woman who, oh, she's amazing, Wahida Amira, who was a librarian in Afghanistan. And then when Kabul fell in August, she basically took to the streets as an activist and a protester and stood up to the Taliban, and at one point actually held her pen up and said, "My pen is stronger than your sword." You know, she is unbelievable, this woman. And I want to write a story. So that's what I'm doing. I'm hoping that I can get a deal for that. We'll see. It's early days, but I want
that's
to write.
That's so appealing, though. Like, it's got to sell.
I would hope so. I would hope so. But that's, yeah. So I'm kind of just putting together.
You have a magpie eye, too.
We do, both of us. We're greedy magpies, aren't we? Well, listen, I cannot thank you enough for giving us an insight into how you work and your beautiful books and your passion for storytelling is just so beautiful. So thank you so much, Brianna.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook, or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.